the largest criminal investigation ever undertaken by the FBI, exposed what came to be known as the Pizza Connection, a mafia-controlled heroin pipeline from Sicily to the U.S. The FBI's war against this drug ring culminated in a 17-month trial that began on October 24, 1985. 22 mafia members, nearly all of them in the food and pizza business, were accused of participating in a $1.65 billion heroin smuggling and money laundering conspiracy. New York Times investigative reporter Ralph Blumenthal covered the trial. He's written a new book about the history of this mafia drug pipeline and how the FBI penetrated it. It's called Last Days of the Sicilians. There's a commonly held belief that the mafia was at one time reluctant to deal in drugs, but Blumenthal says that's a vast misconception.
Yes, there was some reluctance on the part of some American mafia leaders, bosses, to steer clear of drugs for very pragmatic reasons. It got them into trouble. It attracted attention of the authorities. Morally, I think their compunctions, if they had any, had less to do with it. But that is a myth. They were into drugs. As soon as drugs started to boom, members of all families and the bosses were into it, and into it deeply in this country. Sicily felt no compunctions at all. They were into the drug traffic almost immediately on the heels of tobacco smuggling. When tobacco smuggling went down and became less lucrative because of changes in Italian law and patterns of commerce, drugs took their place.
The Pizza Connection starts the way you describe it, with the murder of Carmine Galante, who was a chieftain of the Bonanno family, one of New York's five families.
Right.
And he was dominating the heroin market in the United States.
Right.
And you say he used to charge a $500, quote, license fee per
$5,000,
yes. $5,000 per kilo of heroin. Would you explain how that worked?
Okay. That's kind of shorthand. There was obviously no formal license. People didn't apply for it. There's no paperwork in the mafia. But he made himself the traffic cop of the heroin traffic in America. What he tried to do is put buyers and sellers together and exact a fee. And while $5,000 a kilo may not sound like much in view of the millions and billions that the traffic amounted to, when you realize that thousands of kilos were going back and forth and some of them were being intercepted by the authorities, it came to quite a lot of money, and this is apart from whatever traffic he himself would run. So he was charging the families $5,000 a kilo to arrange, to allow the stuff into the country, and to put buyers and sellers together.
Who knocked him off, and what do you think the motivation was?
Well, as I point out in The Last Days of the Sicilians, it seemed to have been a plot by other members of the Bonanno family, a Sicilian cabal within the Bonanno family, including two of Galante's own dining companions at the Joe and Mary Italian restaurant in Brooklyn on Knickerbocker Avenue. If you can remember back, it was a summer almost as sweltering as this one, 1979. It was a very, very hot day, and Galante went to have lunch with a couple of friends and two of his bodyguards at the time, Cesare Bonventri and Baldo Amato. And while he was eating in the backyard garden of tomato vines, three masked gunmen wearing ski masks burst in with shotguns and pistols and killed him. And miraculously, his two bodyguards escaped, although two other dining companions with Galante were murdered. And it was a mystery almost from the beginning how these two escaped while everybody else was slaughtered. And the reason became apparent not too long after, that they seemed to have been in on it from the pattern of shots, from the way they escaped. As one of the prosecutors said afterwards, it rained bullets and they didn't get wet.
Now, you think that the mafia wanted to kill him so that the heroin market would be more accessible to others?
I think certain elements of the mafia wanted to get in on it. I think the Sicilians were feeling their oats, and while Galante himself was a Sicilian, see, this is very, very complicated. What's Sicilian and what's American?
Mm-hmm.
Because some so-called American mobsters came from Sicily, and yet, although Galante came from Castellammare, which is a very venerable fishing village west of Palermo, where Joe Bonanno came from and a lot of other Bonanno mobsters came from, Galante really grew up in the American mafia. He was an assistant to Joe Bonanno in the early days of Bonanno's regency, and Galante went to Canada to organize the rackets for Bonanno in Canada. And He was, you might say, really part of the American mafia. But within this family, there was a Sicilian group, a Sicilian faction that no one even knew existed. The FBI, with all their eavesdropping and all their surveillance and all their experts, and were caught totally off guard when this faction surfaced. And it was this faction, investigators now believe, and I show in my book, that seemed to have made a move at that crucial time to take the heroin racket away from Galanti.
My guest is New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal, who's the author of the new book, Last Days of the Sicilians at War with the Mafia. And it's about the so-called pizza connection. Now, the murder of Galanti makes it possible for this pizza connection to get into place. Let's talk about what this pipeline is of drugs from Sicily to America. First of all, how is this pipeline established?
Well, the pipeline really took over the old tobacco smuggling routes. This was not anything that was put in place overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It grew up historically out of trade routes, trade of contraband, going back to right after the war. During the war, there was very little trade in anything contraband because all the ships were being used for the war effort. So that was a time when the number of heroin addicts in the United States, by the way, plummeted to 20,000 from today's estimated 500,000. So drug trafficking was just about wiped out during the war. So we're starting now after the war. As commerce reestablishes itself, ships can get back into civilian use, and the Italian mafia, reinstalled, by the way, by the American conquerors of Italy, the victorious American troops looking around for allies, seized on the mafia, which had been just about wiped out, decimated by Mussolini, probably the only good thing Mussolini ever did. These mafia bosses and their underlings now come out of hiding, the ones that were still left alive, and they start to reestablish themselves in the tobacco smuggling business, which was a very, very hot item after the war. You can remember that tobacco was a currency after the war, much in demand, and anyone who could smuggle cigarettes was in fact smuggling gold or currency. And that worked until the early 60s, and with the worldwide traffic in cigarettes becoming less and less important, cigarettes were no longer such a prized commodity. They were available everywhere. There were factories in Italy making them. These same mafia bosses and factions decided that they could shift very easily into drugs. The American appetite for drugs was insatiable, and it became obvious very quickly that this was the way to make money. So they took the old tobacco smuggling routes and just used them now for drugs. And the network was an incredibly complicated and sophisticated one, reaching from Bulgaria, Turkey, to Sicily, to Marseille in the days of the French Connection, the Corsicans out of Marseille, certainly to Southeast Asia in the days of the French occupation of Indochina, and which is where a lot of the morphine base and the heroin, the opium poppies came from, all the way to the United States, which was the end of that line.
When the Sicilians sent the heroin to the mafia in the United States, how was it concealed? What were some of the inventive ways they used to actually smuggle the stuff in?
Terry, it's almost easier to talk about how they didn't conceal it. It was found, and that's the only thing we know. We don't know how it was concealed and not found. It was found in espresso machines, in shoes, in coffee, in tomato cans. It was found, they concocted one especially ingenious method, in olive oil cans. They would take an olive oil can, inside solder a smaller can a little bit off-center that would have the heroin and seal it. And the rest of the can had olive oil. So the customs people in America, when they would test these cans, and they were pretty sophisticated themselves, they would drop a probe, like a stick or so, into the can, and they'd hit oil, olive oil, and they figured the can was all right, not realizing that just off-center was another can with the heroin soldered into it. But then they caught on to that, so the mafia figured out other ways to do it. They body couriered it in. One of the characters I feature in The Last Days of the Sicilians is a very colorful hitman named Luigi Roncisvalli, who describes in some detail how he was tutored in body couriering in heroin around the country, actually, after it had come in. And they told him, put it on your body, and then go rush for a plane at the last minute with a bundle full of luggage and coats and things. And if you're rushing to the plane at the last minute, your arms are full of bundles, it's less likely you'll be stopped. And in fact, he smuggled into different parts of the country about $150 million worth of heroin.
Now, where does the pizza and the pizza connection come in?
Okay, well, your pizza is safe. There is no heroin in the pizza. And I think that was an early misconception by the name. The pizza parlors were used as fronts.
Mm-hmm.
They were convenient cash businesses. They generated a lot of cash. There was a lot of traffic in and out. People could move back and forth without attracting much attention. They were always getting deliveries. So it was a good way to hide the traffic itself and to hide the cash. There was certainly no drugs mixed in with the pizza.
Now, you have a photo. You have a lot of photos in your book that the FBI took during surveillance. One of the photos is of someone in the American Mafia going into another Mafia member's house with a gift-wrapped box that actually contained $250,000. Then a few minutes later, the person walks out with a blue shirt box containing 1 kilo of heroin. Was this a kind of typical transaction?
It is, and it is atypical in that this was a transaction almost completely recorded on videotape and film by the FBI, which made it so extraordinary. These kind of things happen, but they're rarely recorded so perfectly and to such devastating effect. It was kind of funny how the FBI did this, as I describe in the book. Middle-level drug dealer in Philadelphia named Benny Zito was dealing with the top guys in New York who were actually bringing in the stuff, the real leaders of the Sicilian Mafia in New York. And Zito, unbeknownst to him, of course, was dealing with an undercover agent in Philadelphia. And the undercover agent asked him if Zito could get him some drugs, and Zito said yes. And they fixed the price at $250,000 a kilo, which was a fairly representative price at that time. The agent then, it's a DEA agent named Steve Hobson, packed the money up in a box with a teddy bear wrapping so it would show up nicely on the surreptitious FBI pictures. And sure enough, because the phones were all tapped, Zito is seen coming up to the house of his supplier with the teddy bear box of the $250,000. He goes in, and a very few minutes later, he comes out with a blue shirt box containing, they later established, the heroin. And then there's this incredible moment that's captured on the videotape and in photographs as Zito comes out with the kilo of heroin under his arm. In the blue shirt box, he stoops down and kisses the daughter of the mafia kingpin he's just bought the heroin from, who's about 7 years old at the time. And it was an absolutely chilling moment in the courtroom when that video was shown to show this man. It showed the hypocrisy and the insidiousness of these people. On the one hand, pretending to be solicitous of the youth and kissing this little girl with enough drugs there to kill a whole generation of other kids.
Can I ask you briefly to describe how the money was gotten out of America into the Swiss bank accounts, how the money was laundered?
Almost as many ways, Terry, as the drugs came in.
As it was smuggled in, right?
They were incredibly ingenious. And one thing you have to remember about these people, and the FBI speaks of this often, is that they're absolutely tireless.
Mm-hmm.
While you and I knock off for the weekend or take an evening off, these guys are thinking every waking minute and often through the night of how they can make a buck. And often it's only a buck. They don't care how much or little it is, but they are scheming tirelessly. And it's often been said, if they ever put their talents to legitimate business, these guys could be blockbuster businessmen. But in terms of getting out the money, they were equally ingenious as getting the drugs in. They dealt with, at first they were rather unsophisticated. They would just take a bag of money, $100,000, $200,000, and catch a Swiss Air flight out of the country and just deliver the bag at the other end. And at one point, as I say, in Last Days of the Sicilians, the Swiss customs people stop a guy carrying a suitcase with $2 million cash out of the country. And they open up his suitcase, and they see all this money, and all the other Swiss officers come running, and they start to count it. And after $1 million, they give up, and they figure, well, this has a million, the other is of equal size, it also must have a million, so we'll just put it down as $2 million, and then they let him go. They didn't care. He was bringing the money into Switzerland, and that was okay with them. But that was the old way, just carrying bags of money. Eventually, they were making so much money that they could not physically manage to carry it out of the country. It became literally tons of money. So they had to get rid of it through brokerage houses here in New York, and they then engaged in a very complex series of dealings with big brokerage houses, Merrill Lynch, E.F. Hutton, and others, who took their cash, no questions asked, for a very long time, which enraged the Justice Department when it came out. And through these brokerage houses, the money was deposited here and then wired to Switzerland and into Swiss accounts and credited in Switzerland.
Well, you know, I want to talk with you about the role of the FBI in cracking this pizza connection. But first, we have to take a short break. My guest is Ralph Blumenthal, who's a reporter with The New York Times. And we're discussing the subject of his new book, The Last Days of the Sicilians at War with the Mafia, the FBI Assault on the Pizza Connection. We'll be back in just a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Ralph Blumenthal, is the author of The Last Days of the Sicilian, which tells about how the FBI went about their biggest criminal investigation ever, how they broke the heroin pipeline from the Sicilian Mafia to the American Mafia. Now, you describe the FBI as being determined to this time around not just get a chieftain and a couple of soldiers, but to really break a ring. What are some of the key things that they did differently in this investigation than they'd done in previous attempts to deal with the Mafia?
Well, they held themselves back initially. The instinct of every law enforcement agency, and it's certainly a good one, is when you see wrongdoing going on or you find out who's bringing in a load of heroin, is to grab them. In recent years, it became obvious that this wasn't working. Every time you grab somebody, you grab the lower-level echelon, and the kingpins were free to set up another operation all over again. So that wasn't working. The DEA and the FBI realized, even before they joined forces legally in 1982, that they had to build on the information, the intelligence that they'd been getting over the years, and try to attack the upper echelon to find out where this stuff was coming from and who was behind it. And I think that is the genius of this case. What made this case different, not just the 100,000 wiretapped conversations or the 400 agents who participated at the end in the arrests, the 1,000 rolls of film that were shot during the surveillances, but the fact that they were putting together a picture of a vast network stretching from the streets of Brooklyn to Bulgaria and Turkey, and where the stuff was originating. And they were compiling an incredible intelligence base of who these people were in conjunction with the Italian police, who were very helpful. It was really the first time the Americans and the Italians collaborated to this extent. They put together an incredible detailed picture, not all of which even came out in the trial, but that was the genius of this case.
Now, did they use RICO, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, to help indict everybody on as a conspiracy as opposed to as individuals?
Yes, that was a key part of this thing. What RICO made it possible to do is to bring in a whole network and not to focus on individual cases. This guy handled this bit of drugs, therefore we're arresting him for that. But if a group of people get together and conspire over a long period of time, you can charge everybody with a conspiracy, even if somebody had kind of a marginal role in it, if you can prove that they were part of the conspiracy. And that's what the government did.
I think one of the keys in an investigation like this is knowing when it's time to move in and break the case open and start arresting people. Because if you move too soon, then you're not going to have enough evidence, and maybe you'll indict a few people, but you won't get a whole ring. When was the moment right? What made the moment right?
Well, you know, that's a good point, Terry, but they didn't know when the moment was, mm-hmm. and you never do, of course. It's mm-hmm. like life itself. You never know when the right time is to do anything. You got to take a guess. And towards the end of the book, as I describe, I think in some detail, the FBI was tormented by the question of when to bring this thing down. And there were numerous opportunities to do it. They were waiting for one key shipment to come in from Florida, brought in by Gaetano Badalamenti, who was the ousted boss of the Sicilian Mafia, the boss of bosses of the Sicilian Mafia, a very, very fearsome character who was in exile in Brazil. He'd been kicked out of the Mafia for some unspecified insult. And he was down in Brazil, and he was trying to resuscitate his drug network from Brazil. And he was sending a load up. All the FBI knew was that it was 22 containers. They weren't sure of what, and that it was coming into Florida because they had the lines tapped. And they kind of made up their mind that they would seize this load when it came in. But there were people who argued against it. And there was, as a matter of fact, as I say in the book, there was quite a dispute and an angry dispute within the Justice Department over whether to take this load down if they could. There were some people in Washington who urged that the load, which they figured out by then was 22 kilos of cocaine, be allowed into the country in order to trace the network further. And some of the agents here on the spot, supervisors too, said, no way, because if this stuff gets into the country and we lose it, it'll be our butts. No ifs, ands, or buts. It'll be our butts. And they said no, and they were ordered by Washington, you let this stuff into the country, which is quite an interesting reflection on the seriousness of this investigation. And there were officials in Washington who were willing to take the heat. As it turned out, the negotiations collapsed, and this stuff didn't come into the country then, so they didn't have to confront the issue. But it was a thorny question all along, and when they decided to break it up is when this stuff turned out not to come into the country, but one of the key figures in America, one of the key middlemen to this Gaetano Badalamenti in exile in Brazil, when this guy went to see his uncle in Madrid, as it turned out, he had gone from Brazil to Madrid, and he was followed. And the FBI figured if they could follow him to Badalamenti, his uncle, in Madrid, and arrest Badalamenti, that would be the time to bring it down. And that's exactly what happened.
How many guys were actually put away when the case concluded?
Well, let's see. 18 were put away. They started with 22. One was killed during the trial. One was shot and badly wounded. One died of cancer. And one was acquitted. And I think that ends up to 18.
Do you think that the Sicilian-American pizza connection is over?
No, I don't. Uh-huh. I think, as a matter of fact, last spring, which would have been a year after the pizza connection was broken, or at least after the verdicts came in and everybody was sentenced to long prison terms, a second round of arrests took place, and it's now been called Pizza 2. It didn't have the magnitude or the depth of the original pizza connection, but it was conveniently called Pizza 2 because some of the same characters surfaced in both investigations. There may be a Pizza 3 ahead.
You know, I think it's probably a depressing truth that even if this pizza connection had been totally busted, that there'd be another group to move in and fill the void.
Yes, that's true. You know, often prosecutors are asked, and I'm asked, well, what does this mean for drugs? What will there be less drugs in the country? And sadly, you're right. There are always other groups waiting to take on the traffic. But this group, and it was a very sophisticated group, is out of commission. And it's going to take another group some time to develop the same mechanisms and the same smuggling routes and the same expertise. And if they're put out of commission, a third group will have to develop that. And each time the FBI develops more sophisticated methods of tracking them. And, I mean, you know, the bad guys try to always be one step ahead of the FBI, but the FBI is always learning things. And the hope is that the new guys coming along are not going to be as sophisticated. They're going to make more mistakes. And I think that's what's happening. I think it's shifting now. Less experienced people are coming in, and they're going to be easier to catch.
Uh-huh. You know, Shayna Alexander has a book on the Pizza Connection also, focusing mostly on the trial. And she writes in her introduction that she was kind of concerned at this mega trial, a 17-month, $50 million trial, that she had to keep charts and graphs just to figure out who was who, because there were so many people in this cast of characters. And she was concerned, like, how is a jury who isn't even allowed to take notes going to figure out who the people are and what their connection really is? Were you concerned about this kind of thing? You were there at the trial, too,
yes,
covering it for the New York Times.
I was concerned about that in the beginning because I had a terrible time keeping track of the people, and I felt very, very insecure because here I am researching a book on the subject, and I couldn't keep the character straight. I had to go around with a chart, actually, in the courtroom, trying to figure out who was sitting in that seat. That must be so-and-so. And I worried about the jury. But I'll tell you that after 17 months of hearing this testimony and seeing the videos and the FBI witnesses, there was no trouble at all. The jury came to a very, very quick verdict. Under the circumstances, I think they deliberated 5 days, parts of 5 days, which was extraordinarily short for a case of this magnitude. And by their verdicts, and they had to decide some very sophisticated questions. Was this man guilty of masterminding the conspiracy? Did he supervise 5 others? Was this one guilty of these phone calls which facilitated the conspiracy? And going back over the verdict sheet later, you could see that the jury was very, very shrewd in picking out what they convicted people on. And the one guy who was acquitted, it was the son of Badalamenti, who really had only a marginal part in the case. The government argued, I thought persuasively, that he deserved to be convicted also as part of the conspiracy. But acquitting him was not an egregious error.
We only have a couple of seconds left, so I'm just wondering, this case increased your faith in the jury system?
Yes, I would say so. I thought they were a very good jury, and they were not overwhelmed.
One last thing, very briefly. Whatever happened to all the pizza places that were fronts for heroin?
They've kind of changed hands now. It's hard to track them. They've gone probably to some friends, maybe other members of the family. They're not owned by the same people, supposedly, who are in jail, but one can't be sure.
Was this bad for business for pizza parlors in New York?
I don't think so. I kept putting the name of pizza in the headlines every day. I used to get hungry and eat pizza during the recesses, and the FBI agents who were surveilling these places used to order out for pizza from these same places they were surveilling.
That's great. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. His new book is titled The Last Days of the Sicilians at War with the Mafia, The FBI Assault on the Pizza Connection. It's published by Times Books. Blumenthal is an investigative reporter for the Times, and he's currently working on the Tawana Brawley case. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.